Chapter 23 of The Civil Magistrate, Section 1. God, the Supreme Lord and King of all the world, hath ordained civil magistrates to be under him over the people, for his own glory and the public good, and to this end hath armed them with the power of the sword, for the defense and encouragement of them that are good, and for the punishment of evildoers. Section 2. It is lawful for Christians to accept and execute the office of a magistrate when called thereunto, in the managing whereof, as they ought especially to maintain piety, justice, and peace, according to the wholesome laws of each commonwealth. So, for that end, they may lawfully, now under the New Testament, wage war upon just and necessary occasions. Section 2. It is lawful for Christians to accept and execute the office of a magistrate when called thereunto, in the managing whereof as they ought especially to maintain piety, justice, and peace, according to the wholesome laws of each commonwealth. So, for that end, they may lawfully, now under the New Testament, wage war upon just and necessary occasions. Godless people outside the Church of Christ, if by chance they should ever read the preceding chapters on the mediator, effectual calling, the perseverance of the saints, and so on, would consider the topics trivial or even nonsense and the reading tedious. These people dismiss all spiritual matters as irrelevant. They mean irrelevant to their low materialistic interests. Politics, however, is not irrelevant even to these people, and especially to these people. Politics touches many points of our daily living. Our pocketbook is affected by heavy taxes and restrictions on business. Our safety also is affected in matters of war and when criminals roam the city streets. Politics also affects religion. When Dictator Franco and the Roman Church attempt to force American military and civilian personnel stationed in Spain to beg permission of a Roman bishop in order to marry one another, a Christian and the secularist, too, ought to sit up and take notice of what is going on, not just in Spain, but in Washington. Many non-Christians are also interested in the moral problems of war, pacifism, crime, and capital punishment. On these subjects, the Westminster Confession has something to say, and it would not harm the secularist to know what it is. Any conclusion relative to war, capital punishment, the relation of church and state, and taxes, too, depends on some theory of civil government. By what right does a government exist? Does a government have any right to exist? Rousseau wrote, "Man is born free, and everywhere he is in chains." How did this change come about? I do not know. What can make it legitimate? That question I think I can answer. Rousseau then proceeds to defend a theory of government in which Christians can be legitimately banished or executed as antisocial enemies of the state. John Locke has a somewhat different theory, which on the surface at least seems to be less brutal than Rousseau's. An ancient theory tried to explain the state as a development from the family. The Bible and the Confession base state authority on its divine ordination. This is not to be confused with the divine right of kings, nor does it grant government unlimited or totalitarian powers. But it does establish government on right and not on brute force. In another volume, I have analyzed several of the secular theories of the state and have attempted to make clear that the social contract theory, either in Rousseau's form or in Locke's form, and all other secular theories as well, are in the final analysis simply assertions of brute force. My thesis is that secularism necessarily implies dictatorship and totalitarian rule. For example, Aristotle pointedly objects to Plato's communism, but his own theory defines the state as the partnership or community, which includes all partnerships, and the good of the state as the good, which includes all goods. The result is state control of religion and of all human good, nothing excepted. It is only the Hebrew Christian revelation
as exemplified in the condemnation of King Ahab's violation of Naboth's private property, that justifies both the authority of a state and the limitations on that authority. The confession in section 1 states that it is God who has ordained civil magistrates. Their authority comes from him. Therefore, they cannot rightfully act as dictators. Their just powers are only those which God has assigned them. What those powers are and what they are not is indicated here and there throughout the Bible, and appeals to the Bible must settle such questions as pacifism and capital punishment, as well as the principle of private property. This chapter of the Confession, in its first sentence, asserts that God has armed the state with the power of the sword. Such is the Bible's position on war. Even Christian pacifists, whom in spite of their lovely character we believe to have misunderstood the Bible, cannot claim that the Old Testament forbids war. In fact, God explicitly commanded war. Has then God given a different commandment in the New Testament? Since he abrogated the food laws, he might have changed his orders on this point too, but as a matter of fact, he did not. Christ said, "Render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's." Of course, the immediate reference was taxes, but Christ knew that Caesar had an army. He did not refuse to pay taxes to Rome on ground that some of the tribute would be used to support that army. Yet in the United States today, some people think it a Christian duty to refuse to follow Christ's teaching and example. They would rather go to jail than pay one penny to support the military. Of course, in Christ's statement, war is not explicitly mentioned. It is an inference, howbeit a justifiable inference, we believe. But the New Testament provides more than an inference. In Romans 13:4, the power of the sword is explicitly assigned to civil government. This disposes of pacifism. And if the relatively juster governments of the West had been willing to wage war against international criminals, the lives of 20 million Chinese, Koreans, and Russians might have been saved, and the United States would have been in a much safer position today. In addition to the unscriptural agitation in favor of pacifism, there is also a great clamor against capital punishment. Secular humanism propounds the theory that the state has no right to punish anybody for anything. The police, the courts, and the prisons exist only for the purpose of rehabilitation. Secular humanism is devoid of any sense of justice. The criminal is regarded not as a criminal, but as a sick man who needs hospitalization. Since capital punishment obviously does not rehabilitate, life imprisonment must be substituted for it. Of course, by life imprisonment, these humanists do not mean life imprisonment. The Indiana legislature of 1965, as it voted to abolish capital punishment, defeated an amendment that would have kept a murderer in jail for life and provided that he may be paroled after 7 years. So after 7 years, the murderer is free to kill again. Subsidiary to the main theological objection to such a system of penology, there are some practical objections. First, and obviously, a policy of easy parole soon sets the murderer free to murder again. But what is worse, the abolition of capital punishment may prevent any conviction at all. Whether it be the case of an habitual criminal on parole committing a felony, or whether it be the case of a man committing his first murder, the criminal is encouraged to kill the arresting officer or other witnesses to his crime. He has everything to gain and nothing to lose. The murder of the witnesses precludes their testifying in court. The murder of the officer frees the criminal from arrest. This is all pure gain to the criminal. But if perchance he is caught after these additional murders, he faces no greater penalty than if he had not committed them. Just a few more years in jail with a chance of escape or parole. No wonder the wives of policemen ask for the retention of the death penalty. However, the main objections to substituting 7 years rehabilitation for the death penalty are theological and religious rather than practical. The anti-Christian humanist has no sense of justice. He does not believe that man was created in the image of God, Therefore, he sees murder as only an offense against society and not as an offense against God. Without a sense of justice, his sympathies lie with the criminal rather than with his victims. Therefore, he wants to do away with all penalties and substitute rehabilitation. The scripture is very clear on the subject and very clearly in opposition to this secularistic theory. The general principle is that man was created in the image of God, so that anyone who commits murder loses his right to live. Genesis 9:6 reads, "Whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God made he man." The New Testament also arms the state with the power of the sword and expressly rules out rehabilitation as the main motive in punishing crime. Read Romans 13:4 very carefully. "If thou do that which is evil, be afraid, for he beareth not the sword in vain, for he is a minister of God, a revenger, not a rehabilitator, to execute the wrath upon him that doeth evil." The relation of church to state is another lively issue at the present time. Where the Roman Church controls the government, Protestants suffer oppression and physical persecution. Our churches are bombed and our ministers are murdered. The Greek Church, a part of the World Council, has caused the arrest and is prosecuting Protestants for distributing New Testaments. In our own land, the Romanists are constantly attempting to divert public funds to their own purposes. A while back, they were advocating an ambassador to the Vatican and will probably push it again when they see an opportunity. In New Mexico, that is, in the United States, Protestant Indians have been denied by court order the right to hold Protestant prayer meetings, even in their own homes. CF United Evangelical Action, February 1, 1954, page 18. And bills have been introduced into Congress to honor the Virgin Mary by issuing commemorative stamps for the Marian year. Unfortunately, there are also Protestants who want a close tie-in of church and state. Some of the large denominations support lobbies for socialist legislation. But what is worse, there are those who want the state to define the articles of religion. For example, the North Rocky Mount Baptist Church in North Carolina, by majority vote, withdrew from the Southern Baptist Convention. As to the issues involved and the wisdom of their withdrawal, I have nothing to say. It is their legal right to withdraw that is the important point. The minority went to court, and the court awarded them the property. The judge claimed that he did not rule on religious beliefs, but the court defined what a church is and held that a Baptist church could not withdraw from the convention and be independent. Now, certainly, the definition of the church is a religious belief on which denominations differ. The Baptists, contrary to the Presbyterians, have always held to independency and have claimed that there is no ecclesiastical authority superior to the local congregation. But the news reports say that the North Carolina Supreme Court has made it illegal for Baptists to conduct their affairs in accordance with Baptist doctrine. In spite of the fact that the minority has won a legal case in favor of the Southern Baptist Convention, we wonder whether the convention in good conscience can accept the verdict. Will they insist on retaining the local property at the cost of having their beliefs on the nature of the church settled by the civil government? It is also interesting to note that the socialistic Christian Century hailed the decision of the court. This radical periodical wants uniformity and ecumenicity enforced by civil decree when possible. The ecumenicists generally favor centralization of power. They want to control property. They do not object to state churches or even to the Greek persecution of evangelicals. These medieval ways may cause the demise of Protestantism and its return to Rome. Section 3. Civil magistrates may not assume to themselves the administration of the word and sacraments, or the power of the keys of the kingdom of heaven, or, in the least, interfere in matters of faith. Yet as nursing fathers, it is the duty of civil magistrates to protect the church of our common Lord without giving the preference to any denomination of Christians above the rest. in such a manner that all ecclesiastical persons, whatever, shall enjoy the full, free, and unquestioned liberty of discharging every part of their sacred functions without violence or danger. And as Jesus Christ hath appointed a regular government and discipline in his church, no law of any commonwealth should interfere with, let, or hinder the due exercise thereof among the voluntary members of any denomination of Christians, according to their own profession and belief. It is the duty of civil magistrates to protect the person and good name of all their people in such an effectual manner as that no person be suffered, either upon pretense of religion or infidelity, to offer any indignity, violence, abuse, or injury to any other person whatsoever, and to take order that all religious and ecclesiastical assemblies be held without molestation or disturbance. Section 4. It is the duty of people to pray for magistrates, to honor their persons, to pay them tribute and other dues, to obey their lawful commands, and to be subject to their authority for conscience' sake. Infidelity or difference in religion doth not make void the magistrate's just and legal authority, nor free the people from their due obedience to him, from which ecclesiastical persons are not exempted. Much less hath the Pope any power or jurisdiction over them in their dominions, or over any of their people, and least of all to deprive them of their dominions or lives, if he shall judge them to be heretics or upon any other pretense whatsoever. At the time of the Reformation, the state in Protestant countries was looked to for protection against Roman persecution. It was natural, therefore, to assign to the state some prerogatives that later reflection has judged improper. Section 3 of this chapter does not appear here as originally written. Its original form said, "The civil magistrate hath authority, and it is his duty to take order that unity and peace be preserved in the church, that the truth of God be kept pure and entire, that all blasphemies and heresies be suppressed, all corruptions and abuses in worship and discipline prevented or reformed, and all the ordinances of God duly settled, administered, and observed. For the better effecting whereof he hath power to call synods, to be present at them, and to provide that whatsoever is transacted in them be according to the mind of God." When the confession was written, there was a strong Erastian party in England, which held that the church was nothing more than a department of the state. The original confession was not intended in favor of Erastianism, and in fact the Erastians argued against the section as adopted. Yet it seems today that the original section was still too Erastian. It would mean that the President of the United States could call a meeting of the General Assembly, decide what is the mind of God, and approve or veto the acts of the Assembly. If we mention by name some of the recent presidents, the incongruity of such an arrangement would be apparent. In England, where the Anglican Church is essentially Erastian, the incongruity is actualized in the fact that the established church cannot alter its prayer book except by a vote of Parliament, most of whose members are not Anglicans, and similarly bishops are appointed by a prime minister who might be glad if there were no church at all. In the United States, the separation of church and state has been almost universally accepted. Unfortunately, this principle is in danger of becoming misunderstood and transformed into something very different. Ever since the time of Emperor Constantine, civil government has intermeddled in ecclesiastical affairs, and the temptation is now reviving. Our confession states that the civil officials are not to give preference to any denomination of Christians above the others. The Constitution of the United States forbids Congress to enact any law establishing a religion or preventing the free exercise of religion. Well and good. Let us keep it this way. But the secularists wish to alter this principle so as to use the civil government for the purpose of hindering and eventually suppressing Christianity. Public education, grants from certain foundations, and UNESCO not only eliminate all Christian teaching, but actively teach secularism. State universities are beginning to ban Christian organizations from their campuses. In the elementary schools, Christian textbooks are prohibited, but anti-Christian textbooks are adopted and imposed on the children over the protest of local Christians. And William Hurd Kilpatrick, who has taught 35,000 public school teachers, declares that it is undemocratic and therefore should be banned by the government to allow parents to teach their children the principles of their own religion. Other instances of governmental interference in religious affairs include the closing of Amish schools, where Amish ideals of life are different from secular ideals, and the confiscation of the horses of Amish farmers because the Amish, being religiously opposed to any form of insurance, refuse to pay Social Security. Also, there are cases of courts ordering blood transfusions to be performed on people whose religion is opposed to such an operation. The Confession states that no law of any commonwealth should interfere with, let or hinder, the due exercise of religious freedom among the voluntary members of any denomination of Christians, according to their own profession and belief. One side of the coin is separation of church and state. The other side is a true freedom, not merely a grudging toleration of religions.